Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Wolf in the Shadows by Maria Vale, narrated by Sen Annis and Julio Maxwell. In our astronomy, the great wolf lived in the sky. It was the mother of all women, and howled her daughters' names into the winds of night. The Fallen by Linda Hogan. Prologue. 2 days ago, I ate my fiancé. I let that rumble around in my head to see if it stirs anything up. Guilt, or heartbreak, or regret, or anything really, aside from the nausea that is only now subsiding. There is nothing. Well, not nothing. I do have one regret. I would have liked to go back to Monsieur Trenet, the terribly posh and oily on-site event coordinator at the Windsor Grand Montreal, who had helped me spend ever greater amounts of my uncle's money on personalized damascene linens with interlinked initials, on stippled mirrors cut to reflect the twinkling of hundreds of candles, on rows of ivy-encrusted chandeliers dripping with hothouse lilacs. I would have liked to have seen his expression when I asked for my money back.
Malheureusement, j'ai mangé mon fiancé, alors puis-je récupérer mon acompte?
Unfortunately, I've eaten my fiancé, so can I get my deposit back? Chapter 1. Julia. This is not my native range. I hug the dyed mink fur bucket bag that normally comes in indigo, but because they know me at the little shop in Montreal's Mille Carré Doré, they put in a special order. Bright red, the color of sour cherries. It was the color of Cass's favorite shoes, the bright red rhinestone-studded knock-me-down-and-fuck-me sandals I bought at the D&G, also at the Mille Carré. For the final touch, I'd taken the spool of thread that I'd used to help match the dye on my bag to the girl at La Belle Dame Sans Merci. And we'd spent the good part of the morning picking over colors until we settled on a glossy sour cherry red.
It's called Irresistible,
the girl said, shaking the bottle as she knelt before my freshly scrubbed feet. La Belle Dame is just off the Boulevard de Maisonneuve, in the Mille Carré Doré, the Golden Square Mile. Because that is my native range. Not this. Not sitting on a thin mattress barely supported by the sagging springs of a bunk bed deaccessioned from some military training camp and now jammed against a wall in a damp cabin in the middle of a mud and bug and blood and wolf-infested hellhole. I would scream, but I've done it already, and no one heard me, or no one cared. When Cassius told me we were going to New York for the weekend, I went ahead and got tickets for Hamilton. I made reservations at Massa. I'd already picked out a black shantung suit, high-buttoned, fitted jacket, bracelet sleeves, because New York theaters can be so cold. But Cassius poked around my closet looking for something sexier. Eventually, he pulled out this— a one-piece pantsuit with palazzo pants below, low-cut halter above. It was beautiful. Made of a white silk that's heavy as chainmail, it flowed like water around my curves. It did leave my back bare, but when the theater AC became too much for me, I would be able to shiver and rub my arms, and Cassius would roll his eyes and give me his jacket, the satin lining still warm from his body, to protect my nakedness, and I would feel cosseted. Last minute, I took off the earrings and put on the four-strand collar of the palest blue pearls. It is my favorite. I like the way it sets off my throat. Except, the next day when Cassius met me at Saint-Hubert Airport, he came not with tickets, but with a half-dozen rich old farts and a pimped-out van. It turned out I'd been misled. Instead of flying with him to New York City, we were taking the pimped-out van and the half-dozen rich old men to some hunting retreat.
You promised me, Cass.
What I promised you,
he said through clenched teeth so he wouldn't be overheard,
was a long weekend in New York, and we will be in New York.
You know I thought you meant the city. And why do I have to sit in the back with the old farts?
Because I'm the only one who knows where we're going. And they're not old farts, Julia. They're contacts. Very useful contacts. This is a chance for me to get to know them, to prove myself, so when August finally realizes that he won't live forever and needs to groom someone to take over, we are in a position to inherit.
I felt used, like I always do whenever Cassius talks about my Uncle August. I mean, I guess I shouldn't blame him. There are only so many jobs for werewolves in Canada, and my uncle controls most of them. I just wish Cass would leave me out of it.
Be charming. I know you know how to do that. Then, when we're all done, I will take you to New York.
City.
Yes,
he said.
New York City.
I need to cancel my reservations. You know how hard they are to get, and I don't want to be put on a list of no-shows. It didn't matter that I wasn't happy. I've spent a lifetime learning how to look like I am. I sat in the back and cooed and laughed and offered drinks while the old farts told me about the hunt my uncle had arranged for them, about how he'd stalked some ancient forest with game.
Not game, Alfred. Predators are not game,
interrupted Clement, a septuagenarian I knew through my mother, whose cock got hard when I was 15, but now that I was 32, was energetically flaccid.
Of course they are, Clement. Anything I can shoot is game. You could be.
I didn't know what the feud between these men was about, but I knew it was my job to distract them. I told them how I'd never killed anything and couldn't stand the sight of blood. Then I lowered my head, bit my lip, and looked up at them through my lashes. Every one of them, all but Clement, hurried to assure me that they would protect me from the wolves. I smiled gratefully and shrugged diffidently and squashed any questions about what my uncle was up to, like I always had. I was irresistible, all the way to a tent in the middle of Mudville, decked out like some vaguely rusticated wedding party, with crystal that shone like baccarat, and chased silver dishes filled with food that I didn't touch, because, as my mother always said, it's impossible to be charming when your mouth is full. There was a lovely rich and meaty bandol, though, and just as I was pouring another glass, the world turned upside down. Two enormous wolves, one dark gray and one white, leapt on the tables and crunched on the hands of the old farts, the little bones making a snick like celery sticks. These wolves stained the white damask tablecloths with blood, which I didn't care about, and with that lovely rich and meaty bandol, which I did. There were gunshots, and a man I didn't know died, shot straight through the middle of his forehead. A puddled mess came out the back, staining the hem of my pants. It matched my nail polish. It was, I thought numbly, irresistible. It was the first death I'd ever seen, and I, of course, screamed. After that, I lost track of what happened. The old farts, who hadn't even been able to protect themselves from wolves, disappeared back into the van, and it was silent, except for the humming of the generators. Then, a man loomed in front of us, cold as night, holding a gun. I knew nothing about Tiberius, except that he was supposed to be dead, and that while my Uncle August was his father, his mother was not August's wife. His mother was a bitch. That's what my mother called her. I didn't think anything of it, figuring it was just my mother's general disdain for the hoi polloi, until later I discovered that despite dressing like humans and talking like humans and going to school and work with humans, we were not, in fact, human. The difference is that we Lucani don't give in to our bestial natures. The werewolves do. During the full moon, they are forced to trot around on all fours and bark and sniff and eat raw meats. Sometimes, I hear, they do it even when they're not forced to. Tiberius, being Lucani like us, didn't have to, but was incomprehensibly angry about it, shoving his gun into Cassius's face and yelling about the Iron Moon, the 3 days out of 30 when the pack must be wild. When I should be wild, but no, because I have to fucking babysit you. At first, I clung to the certainty that my Uncle August would get us out of this mess, like he always did for every mess, big or small. But then Constantine, his second in command, said that August is dead, which I can't believe, because August is too powerful to just die. Even when Tiberius shot him through the neck, he didn't just die. Except, Constantine insisted that he'd watched a werewolf kill him. No, that's not what he said. What he said was he watched while she shoved a metal bar through his throat. As though a girl could kill August Levereaux. Now, after 3 days, August still hasn't come, and all that's happened is I've gotten damper and colder, and my feet hurt more, and things, little birds and little animals, keep moving around, and it reminds me of a horror movie about a cabin in the wood. In fact, I think that was the name that Cassius made me watch. He knew I hated horror movies, but he made me watch because one of the characters was named after me. Not Julia, which is my name, but Jules, which is what he calls me. That or baby. They made us walk through the woods, my D&Gs slowly turning my feet from irresistible to irredeemable. As I sat staring at the mess of broken blisters, plastered with drying mud, the most beautiful man I've ever seen knelt in front of me, like in some perverted retelling of Cinderella. Slim, graceful, eyes the bright silver of summer water above high cheekbones, long sculpted nose. His upper lip is a little short, above a full lower lip. The long stubble would look messy on anyone else, but on him, it was a shadowing on carved elegance.
"I forget how humans feel about socks," he said,
looking up under long dark lashes.
"Is it like sharing underwear?"
I don't know if I answered, but somehow, I ended up wearing socks still warm from his skin and comfortable over large boots that are spotted and stained across the saddle, with toes worn to a shine. Then he stood, tucking his hair behind his ear. I stared at his long, pale, high-arched feet, and Tiberius called him Arthur, like the king, and I tried to think of something to say to him that would show I was grateful but wouldn't piss off Cassius. I couldn't. The next time I saw him, he was splayed out on damp grass, surrounded by hundreds of men and wolves. This time, his entire body was bare. He was slim and perfectly proportioned, like a god. Not one of the burly, chest-thumping, thundering gods. More like Dionysus. Though he had a cock that was nothing like the discreet penises of classical statuary. And when someone whispered to him, he tucked it between his legs. The bad feeling I had about whatever was about to happen got worse when a pale gray wolf curled up next to him, its head under his chin, its paw on his shoulder, and ripped him open. From shoulder to hip, it ripped him open. Then they all just turned their backs and walked away, while gore bubbled up across the beautiful man's pale skin and watered the high grass. It was bright, I noticed, and sour cherry red. It was irresistible. At least there was someone screaming at the horror of it. It took me a minute to realize that the screams rattling around in my head were my own. After that, it was all bad and blurred together until I ended up alone in this damp cabin on this thin mattress. In the bathroom, on the wall above the enameled sink, was a tiny hand mirror hanging from a nail. Reflected in it is a woman I barely recognize. With a damp corner of a towel, I dab away the taupe shadow that's run into dark puddles under my eyes and into tiny lines at the corners. My pantsuit, the one that was once a beautiful white silk, heavy as chainmail that flowed like water around my curves, is now stiff and stained with mud and that delicious meaty bandeau and the blood of the man who died and the blood of the man who dared to help me. Plugging up the sink, I run cold water,
There is shampoo in the shower that has a picture of a dog. I try not to think about it as I pour long streams of it into the slowly collecting water. Tears pour in long streams to join it. When I was little, my father took me to the botanical garden in Montreal. I had seen a slug there, and being too young to know better, I thought someone had torn a snail out of its shell and left it naked and dying. My father didn't know what I was crying about. He didn't try to find out. He just gathered me into his strong arms and held me tight and called me princess and told me that I would never have to worry while he was there. Then, when my father died, August came. He didn't hug me, but when he saw how upset I was about the lobster tank, he raised two fingers in the air, and the entire restaurant was rearranged so I wouldn't have to see my dinner flailing as it was fished out of the water.
"You have nothing to worry about, Julia," he'd said. "I will take care of everything."
Now August is gone, too. I turn off the faucet and swish my pantsuit around, feeling just like I had imagined that slug had felt, naked and vulnerable. Opening my mink bag, I pull out my lipstick and, with a shaking hand, trace the familiar bow and curve of my mouth. I suck my lips in and let them go with a pop. Once again, they are sour cherry red. Irresistible.
Chapter 2. Arthur. I can almost hear her again. The urgency in Grand Sigeberg's voice. "If you are slighted, the fire will not burn. If you are angry, the fire will not burn. If you are in pain, the fire will not burn." I was very little when I made that promise to her and to the whole of the Great North in return for my life. Would you be proud of me, Grand Sigeberg? Would you be proud? A wolf's claws are not retractable. We are not like cats padding around with little switchblades tucked up inside. Our claws scrape across rocks and dirt and wood so that when Silver clawed me, it wasn't a clean razor slice. It was a ragged tear made with four dull screwdrivers. The pain came in waves, pain like pulsing whips of fire that broke nerves, followed by strangely comforting liquid warmth spreading across my chest, followed by a dull throb that emptied my body's blood and heat with every beat of my heart. Coppery fumes surround me. When I wake up, a wolf is howling. I know who it is, though she doesn't sound like she did back when she was Varya, the alpha shielder of the Great North Pack's 12th echelon, my echelon. Then she was stern and unyielding. Now she is tentative, questioning as she tries to understand who she has become. One mountain stands alone to the west, taller than the rest. Its pinnacle is scoured by winds, leaving nothing but the thin, bent trees of the Krumholtz, the crooked woods.
Winterbern, Windwo, se ende werd, Weirwold, el forsworen, forsaken, nefna, Ekewulfa. Winter blasted, wind twisted, the world's last sentinel. Forsworn, forsaken, by all but the forever wolf.
August had timed the arrival of the hunters perfectly, so they would come across us at the moment of our change when, neither wolves nor in skin, we are entirely vulnerable. We were all waiting for the pull of the iron moon on our wild when Varya told us that they were on their way. Then the lone wolf she loved and had hidden from us howled to tell us that the hunters were already here. And Varya did what she always had. She acted. The Iron Moon takes us as she finds us and makes us wilder. If she finds us in skin, she makes us wild.
If she finds us wild, she will make us Ekewulfas, real wolves, forever wolves.
The Alpha begged Varya not to change, knowing that if she did, she would never walk on two legs again, never speak to her again. Varya did it anyway. Then she and her white wolf clung to who they had been just long enough to save us all.
I touched the ragged edge of my skin. Varya had the same scars, the scars that were meant to brand a wolf who had broken the law. In the end, was it just a few days ago? I told her that I would have the same marks she had, and that I would be proud to bear them. Coyotes snuffle noisily at the edge of the clearing, a reminder that if I don't get moving, there will be no scars, no marks, no me. I've never paid too much attention to coyotes before. They keep us alert when we are alive and eat us when we're dead. Which is why we call them Wolfbergena, wolf tombs. They are usually only trouble for the very young, the very old, or the very injured. I'm dizzy and tired, and all I want to do is curl up in the grasses and sleep again. But I'm pretty sure if I do, I will be eaten. I need to focus, keep my mind from falling apart just long enough to get to the Innenlandes, the inner lands around the Great Hall. The Innenlandes are made safe by the constant comings and goings of wolves. Even the littlest pups run freely under the ferns and the fierce markings of the pack. At first, I try to pull myself up on my elbows, but contracting the muscles in my torso strains the few remaining fibers keeping my outsides together and my insides in. Lying back down, I pull my knees up, digging my heels into the soft, damp earth, then pushing myself backward like a naked, inverted inchworm through the grasses of the clearing, focusing on reaching the dark, cool protection of the surrounding forests. Usually, we avoid the exposure of the clearing, except for certain rituals, most of which, now that I think of it, end with someone bleeding. This was where we held the slitung, the slicing, when we killed drunken, exiled Ronin for kidnapping a pup. I took part, every wolf did, so that we would all bear responsibility for the life we'd failed. This is where each echelon, each age group, holds its darling, when wolves fight for position within the hierarchy and begin their lives as adult members of the pack. This is where Lorkin fought and became alpha of the 12th echelon. This is where I didn't fight and became the 12th snidling. There's an old saying that lone wolves at the bottom of the pack are the only ones who always breed, their children being frustration and dissent. That is why they are given over to the echelon's alphas, to be their servants, their nidlings. It is meant to be a life of endless submission, leaving the lone wolf too tired, I suppose, for either frustration or dissent. I killed Victor because of dissent, but it wasn't mine. It was his. He was our deemer, our thinker about the law, and he spread dissent through the pack, threatening the cohesion that is so crucial to our survival. Then, he betrayed us to August Levereaux. That is why I jammed a butter knife into his sternum. Must be the blood loss, but suddenly that strikes me as the funniest thing I've ever heard. I jammed a butter knife. I laugh until it hurts, which is immediately. Silver is now the deemer, and she decided that nidling is one ancient tradition the pack can do without, so now I will be the Omega. It suits me. I have always been attentive, and now that is my duty. While it is up to the Alphas to manage fights, it is up to the Omega to look for silent divisions that are no less deadly. The setting sun has gilded one side of the clearing's grasses gold while the other is thrown into shadow, and coyotes bark with bad intent. The sky is purple by the time I reach the woodlands, and find a branch and a trunk and maneuver myself onto 2 feet, my weak right arm across my waist, trying to keep my intestines in. I stumble as my foot catches the thorn of one of the black locusts that have taken root. What did I do with my boots? That's right, I gave them to the female shifter. What did Lorkin call her? Hail, hey, Sivatan. She is the siftings. She is what is left when everything of value has been removed. I know why Lorkin said that. She seemed helpless as an injured pup, but then I saw her. As my blood poured, she lashed out at Silver, fought Tiberius, and attacked the Alpha Rock as though she wanted to take on the Alpha herself. until the man in the black suit wrapped his arms around her and called her, "Baby, baby, baby." Then the fire flared briefly hotter before it burned out entirely and left nothing but ash. What's left when everything useful has been burned away? There's a familiar noise, paws changing directions, followed by a discomfited rop. For a minute, I think this is it. It's dark now, and the coyotes are massing quietly in the trees. Except the coyotes' warning is more of a rarp. Rop is a sound made by wolves. They are running in slow circles. I can tell by the way I lose their scent when they are downwind, only to find it again when they are upwind. The Alpha, Tiberius, Tara, Lorcan. By law, they are not allowed to protect or comfort me. It's meant to teach the clawed wolf what the loss of pack really means. Still, these wolves, some of the strongest of the Great North, run in circles, scaring off the coyotes. Wolves don't run in pointless circles. Humans run in pointless circles. I forgot what it's called. Jogging, that's the word. Finally, I reached the huge old cottonwood that blew down many moons ago, and we never bothered to collect because it sparks and the smoke stings our noses. Beyond it is the safety of the Inlandis. If I were wild, I would breeze over it. Now I sit on it and let myself fall backward. I give myself into it all. The deep striations of the bark rasping against my bare skin, the kaleidoscope of the stars above, the scent of black earth and wood rot below, and the warm and musky comfort of wolves.
Chapter 3. Julia. Anyone would recognize me as a St. Alba's girl. Anyone in Montreal, at least. Even though it's been over a dozen years since I last wore the plaid pleated skirt, rolled up to mid-thigh whenever possible, or the bright white shirt with a Peter Pan collar that was stiff and smelled like bleach. It's something about the polished skin, the makeup that neither reveals nor covers, hair, blown, layered, at a length that cups the breasts if you have curls, or runs over them like a waterfall if you don't. The way of walking and standing and sitting and talking that was burned into us.
Vous devez vous tenir bien droite, la tête haute, Mademoiselle Pivot,
the dancing mistress would say. You must hold yourself straight, your head high. Except then she'd slap the back of my knees with her cane, to remind me that in keeping my back straight, I had to bend my knees as much as possible, so that when our partners from Saint-Hubert arrived, they could pretend to be taller than I was. One of the things I most loved about Cassius is that he was tall enough for me to walk upright. I bat another low-hanging branch away. It stings the hand that slapped Cassius. What was I thinking? He was so angry. I told him that I was confused, and so frightened by the sight of blood. I licked my lips, and told him how much I needed him, how I trusted him to take care of me, how I believed in him when he said he'd get me out of here. Tomorrow, he'd said, 4 days in a row. Not that I said anything, because saying anything would make him think that I didn't believe in him, and he would get angrier. The roots of the trees are all tangled and humped together, like heaving waves under my borrowed boots. Or, not borrowed, because the man who lent them to me is dead. I started out this morning on my own, because there is simply no way I am going to spend another night alone in that cabin. It is not a bright, cheery bungalow at the end of a broad path, surrounded by climbing roses and meadow flowers, like you see in puzzles. It's surrounded by a million dark trees, and has exactly 3 dim lights that seem to serve no purpose but to create creepy shadows. And I, foolish girl that I am, had always believed that it was supposed to be warmer inside than it was outside, but that cabin was exactly as cold as the night air outside. I tried to close one of the windows, but when I took off the screen and stretched my arm outside to pull the hinged window closed, moths flew in and hit my face and joined an army of thin green bugs flittering around the lights. I dragged a mattress from a bunk and shoved it as far from the windows as I could,
then laid down with two blankets over my head. I could still...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?